The North Carolina Reading Service presents this program for our blind and print-impaired listeners. John Federson with you, and the current issue of Indie Week. It's dated January 6, 2021. Hooray! We're back. After 2 weeks, with our studios closed on my regular recording day. I'm so glad to return. I'm attempting a new experiment this week, and that's to create our beautiful theme music through brain power alone. My mind has already been examined by many mental professionals, some of whom are observing me right now through one-way glass, as our violin and piano are literally imagined into existence. Oh, I must reluctantly fade that out now so I can concentrate on the Indie Week issue. And we'll go right to our cover story, Inside Durham's COVID Motel, written by Leah Toss. Recently released inmates from all over the state are being held at Durham's Quality Inn. Some say this is just another prison. Keith Bubba Lusk just wanted to buy his three kids gifts for Christmas. The stocky 28-year-old had been incarcerated for nearly a year since robbing a drugstore in 2019, but his release, scheduled for December 8th of 2020, meant he might find a job in time for the holidays. "That all got shot to hell," Lusk says during a phone call on Monday. For the past 30 days, he has been involuntarily held at the Quality Inn on Hillsborough Road in Durham, the state's temporary COVID motel, with about 100 other former inmates awaiting release into the general public. Lusk, who is from Rutherford County, about 3 hours away, isn't sure why he's there. "He spent his sentence in isolation and tested negative before leaving prison," he says. "On a normal day, he paces his room and tries to get some exercise, but mostly ends up sitting in bed. There's no washing machine in his room, so he has to wash the one set of clothes he brought from prison in the bathtub, using a small amount of detergent provided by the motel. Once you run out, they don't give you no more, so you got to wash your clothes in water," Lusk says. "You get treated like crap. They still treat you like you're an inmate." He isn't sure when he'll be allowed to leave. While the motel was meant to provide temporary housing for the men while they sought out permanent accommodations during the pandemic, the residents and the activists who support them say conditions are nearly as bad as the prison itself. There are bed bugs, cockroaches, a leaky ceiling, and other hygiene concerns, they say. Worse still, the men, who are supposed to be free, are unable to see their families or even receive donations of food and other provisions from the outside world. They can't leave their rooms other than to smoke cigarettes on the patio. Their only escape is a motel room television, they say. That's why on Christmas, a group of volunteers from Rose of Sharon Baptist Church in Durham came by the motel to drop off home-cooked meals for the detainees. But according to the activists, the private security guards hired by the state to oversee the motel turned them away. So the church volunteers took justice into their own hands. On New Year's Day, the group returned to the motel with care packages for the men and snuck in through a back stairwell. The Indy tagged along to investigate. "What we witnessed inside the COVID motel left us with questions about the facility's legality, some of which remain still unanswered." Officials say the program started with good intentions. Conceived as a temporary place for recently released convicts without a permanent address who may have been exposed to COVID in prison, the city and county of Durham entered into an agreement with the State Department of Public Safety this summer to enact the pilot program, the only one of its kind in North Carolina. Instead of releasing men with nowhere to go into the general public, leasing the 114-room motel would offer a COVID-19 safe alternative for those who had successfully completed their prison sentences while they sought accommodations. While there, they would receive medical care and counseling. The state hired a private security company, Lolaire Protection Agency, to act as de facto correction officers on site. While some of the men are under electronic surveillance as a condition of their release, others are not. It's unclear what role this agency plays in enforcing protocol at the facility, beyond nuisance and non-emergent incidents, according to the memorandum of agreement with the city and county. The $1 million program was funded mostly by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Public Assistance Grant Program, and the state's CARES Act, according to DPS. A November memo from the DPS to the city stated that 114 men had cycled through the facility and that most had been released back into the community. Only 10 had left unauthorized, walking out on their own accord. But it's still a motel. There are no gates or locks on the door, which would be a fire code violation. Yet leaving isn't allowed without permission from the inmate's parole officer, so, fearing further punishment, the majority of men have followed the rules and stayed put. In an email, DPS spokesman Greg Thomas told Indy that a total of 263 recently released individuals have been housed at the facility since the start of the program, and there are currently 80 on site. To date, 173 have successfully transitioned to more permanent housing. Thomas confirmed that there have been at least 4 complaints of bed bugs at the facility. Food is prepared at the motel and sometimes provided by local restaurants. Outside donations, however, are prohibited, quote, for the safety of residents, hotel staff, and the community, Thomas said. The offenders are not being held, he stated. They are being housed so they may quarantine for their safety and the safety of their families and communities. This housing option is part of the offender's condition of post-release supervision. The North Carolina Post-Release Supervision and Parole Commission is the controlling authority on housing options as offenders move to post-release, and it is approved by the offender's supervising probation and parole officer. After contacting Indy, DPS sent Durham City Council member Charlie Reese an update on the facility, which he shared with us. That memo stated that most complaints stem from plumbing and electronic issues, such as broken phones or TVs. They have also received a few complaints of roof leaks on the third floor and leaks due to mechanical issues on the second and third floor, the memo states. These issues, it continues, were promptly addressed. The state is contracting with Terminix to control bedbugs, treating about a third of the motel on a monthly basis and shuffling residents whose rooms become infested to other parts of the motel. This weekend, they received complaints of rodents and roaches on the property, according to the memo. The goal of the program is to find housing placement for the men within 2 weeks. However, the memo acknowledges that some of the residents, like Lusk, have been detained for much longer. At least one man who was transferred to the facility subsequently tasted positive for COVID-19, but the DPS claims the man was isolated on an upper floor and that there was, quote, no further spread. Comparatively, the virus has spread rapidly within the state's prison system. 9,432 inmates have tested positive and 67 have died since the pandemic began, according to data from the state. There are currently 63 outbreaks being reported at the state's penitentiaries. The state prison system's mismanagement of the pandemic is the subject of an ongoing lawsuit from the ACLU and Emancipate NC. That suit claims that the DPS failed to enact safety protocols, resulting in outbreaks within the jails. The advocacy groups are demanding the release of at-risk inmates. While the COVID motel is not directly related to the lawsuit, ACLU attorney Dan Siegel tells the Indy that the state has a responsibility to provide minimally sanitary and safe conditions to anyone in its custody. And he says the possibility that the state is detaining people beyond their release dates is troubling. And he goes on, any time their sentence has expired and the state is keeping them in custody beyond their legal sentence, that creates a serious problem. People's constitutional rights don't go away in the middle of a pandemic or any other emergency. If the state is going to keep someone in its custody and prevent them from leaving, they have to give them due process and can't just prolong someone's sentence unilaterally because they think it's a good idea. Elizabeth Simpson, Associate Director for Emancipate NC, echoes Siegel's concern. And she tells the Indy, I think it was a good idea, but if the conditions are intolerable and they are being mistreated, then obviously that is not the way it should be done. My experience at NCDPS, unfortunately, is that they have plans that sound passable, and then their implementation is not passable at all. When reached by the Indy on Monday night, Durham Mayor Steve Shule said he did not have enough information to comment, but that he'd be looking into the matter. It was a bait and switch. At the main entrance to the motel on New Year's Day, older church volunteers knock on the door to once again attempt to donate homemade vegetarian chili and milk rolls to the men inside, distracting the guards. Meanwhile, a second group mobilizes in the Hilton parking lot next door, with dozens of plastic bags full of food, detergent, and cigarettes strung from their arms. Four vigilante activists walk into the property from the back, climbing a stairwell to gain entry into an unlocked door on the third floor. Inside, the motel is dark, with seedy yellow walls. It's eerily quiet. As the activists rush from door to door, dropping off supplies, some of the men open their doors, including Lusk. He's bald, with a goatee and a white sweatsuit. He looks older than his 28 years. He picks up his care package and smiles. It's a humble offering, a few instant meals, fresh fruit, detergent, and cigarettes. It's been hell, he tells me, standing outside his room. It's how they treat us. More men start to open their doors as the activists storm the halls. We linger for a moment with Lusk and try to get a peek inside a room before a guard rushes toward us, forcing us back to the stairwell. When the guard confronts Gregory Williams, one of the vigilante organizers, he grabs Williams by the collar of his jacket and slams him against the wall. The guard tells us we're being detained and calls the police. By now, more men are opening their doors and windows. Their joy at this simple kindness is palpable. Some cheer. Some shout thank yous at the group. We're here to support you guys. We love you, Williams shouts to a group of men on the third floor balcony. We're just sorry we couldn't do more, his wife, Chrissy Nesbitt, says. You did enough, replies one of the men. One of the activists is live streaming the affair from an iPhone. For about 20 minutes, we remain cornered by private security guards in the stairwell awaiting the police. A team of green-hatted legal observers arrives, followed by a police officer. Officer C.W. Bridwell confronts the green hats. He then tells us no one's being detained and asks us to leave. Despite the ban on donations, the men are allowed to keep the care packages. From a third-floor window, Lusk waves to the vigilante do-gooders as they regroup in the Hilton parking lot. On the first floor, a man tosses an unclaimed care package to the outstretched arm of a detainee leaning from the second-floor balcony. The activists, relieved, seem to smile beneath their N95 face masks as they head to their cars. Lusk stands in the window, his arms crossed. Our next story, produced through a partnership between Indy and the Ninth Street Journal. Legal Eagle, and it's about attorney T. Greg Doucette, who some of us remember as a regular contributor, actually, to the Indy issues. It's about his social media crusade against hypocrisy, police violence, and big government. It was 5 days after the police killing of George Floyd, and T. Greg Doucette was mad. Doucette, a criminal defense and small business attorney in Durham, was angry with the way police were treating protesters, beating them, pepper spraying them, and in one case, even trampling them with a horse. And so, around noon on May the 30th, Doucette did what he often does when he wants to gripe. He tweeted, creating a thread of 10 videos showing instances of police brutality toward protesters. His thread went viral, retweeted by Trevor Noah and John Cusack and scores of others. Twitter analytics showed that it reached millions of users. Suddenly, police started sending him thousands of videos of police violence. People started sending him thousands of videos of police violence, and Doucette kept adding to the thread with a counter so people could keep track. He gained 100,000 followers on top of his previous 30,000. Soon, the police brutality mega thread had ballooned to hundreds of clips. It was like, holy crap, this has gone beyond what I expected, he says, and I got to figure out how to manage it. Doucette's sudden Twitter fame was partly a reflection of the moment, a nation waking up to the pervasive problem of police violence, and partly a product of his Twitter addiction. He'll often tweet 100 times a day. But through the 100,000 Twitter followers were new, the blistering honesty of the thread was not. Whether he's insulting Jeff Sessions, human gutter trash, or skewering the University of North Carolina Board of Governors, Doucette will give you his unvarnished opinion. Since 2017, he has hosted a podcast called F Them All, in which he rails against corruption and abuse in the justice system, as well as what he calls political effery. Recently, he's taken to YouTube to challenge Van Jones, a news commentator who gave a TED talk titled, "What if a U.S. presidential candidate refuses to concede after an election?" In it, Jones explains how a president could exploit legal loopholes in the Constitution to stay in office. The Durham lawyer's response is quintessential Doucette, funny, thorough, nerdy, and crass. His video has attracted over 130,000 views and some controversy. When someone in the comments section disputed one of his claims, Doucette weighed in. Basically, every comment and reply you've made here is wrong. It's actually impressive. Enjoy the Biden administration. He's a rascal and a reformer, a crusader for justice, or, if you're on the receiving end of his Twitter onslaught, a pain in the neck. A former attorney at Doucette's firm says Karan Myers Davis. And he say, if you're being an ass, he'll push back. He'll push back at you on Twitter. He'll push back at you in public. He'll push back on people in his real life who aren't living their values, or who are being unethical or condescending or rude. That's just who he is. Both times I interviewed Doucette, writes our author, Chris Kuo, he appeared on my screen wearing black headphones and a gray shirt that read NCCU Trial Advocacy Board. Bald, 39 years old, he's a self-described full-time curmudgeon, part-time Twitter celebrity, occasional attorney. Doucette talks like he tweets, nonstop, unfiltered, his words laced with zingers and occasional F-bombs, his face lit with an impish smile. Unlike most advocates for criminal justice reform who come from the left, he's a conservative, though he abandoned the Republican Party after Trump's election. He's now registered as unaffiliated. His watchdog mentality reflects his skepticism about the state. I don't trust the government, he says. If you allow the government to steamroll people that don't have power, they're going to steamroll the people that do the first chance they get. His strategy is simple. You have to keep the government in its little box. And if it ever steps out of the box, you smack it in the face and you put it back in the box. Doucette grew up in Virginia Beach in a home where his mother and stepfather fought a lot. And he wrote on the website for his state Senate campaign in 2016, I grew up in the type of home many would consider white trash, poor, frequent substance abuse, more frequent domestic violence, something so normal in my life I didn't even know it was called domestic violence until law school. In high school, he was recruited by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology for its computer engineering program, but he decided on attending North Carolina State University because tuition was cheaper than a setback. His parents refused to provide him with tax information, so Doucette couldn't qualify for financial aid. He dropped out, worked odd jobs, lived out of his truck, and used his girlfriend's dorm room to shower. When he finally got enough money to enroll, he became president of the UNC's Association of Student Governments, a group that includes student representatives from schools across North Carolina, including NC State. He eventually graduated with a degree in computer science. Ashley Yop, who met him through the Association of Student Governments, says Doucette was fun, but in a nerdy kind of way. At parties, instead of playing beer pong, Doucette would be deep in conversation with somebody about a new idea. He talks big, but he doesn't put on airs. He is who he is. In 2009, Doucette enrolled in North Carolina Central School of Law. He picked Central because it was cheaper than UNC. After graduating, he wanted to start a nonprofit called NC Spice that would be an incubator for other attorneys trying to set up their practices. He says, rummaging through his computer for a picture, "The logo was a pepper grinder with the scales of justice. Really slick, man." But Doucette hit a speed bump when the IRS stopped processing applications for nonprofit groups. So Doucette started his own firm, kind of by accident. He chose Durham because of the resources and connections at Central. He was sworn in as an attorney in 2012. He eventually founded the nonprofit and now works as its executive director. He started out focusing on business litigation and higher education law. He fell into criminal law by happenstance. "For whatever reason," he said, "I still had this old school Republican notion that criminal defense lawyers are just icky creatures." In 2013, he took on a client who was a student at Central and had been caught selling weed. It became a turning point in his legal career. During the first conversation, according to Doucette, the student said he wanted to be Durham's weed man. The student had bought a business plan on how to sell weed, complete with marketing projections and a color-coded map of everywhere in the country it was legal. Doucette recalls, "You know how you watch movies and you hear the record scratch moment and everyone freezes? That's how it was during the client interview." Though he thought it would be impossible to help the student receive a lenient sentence, Doucette took on the case. In 2014, he defended the student in court, and to his surprise, the court accepted his argument and dismissed the case. Later in the hallway of the Durham courthouse, the client grabbed his arm. Doucette remembers him saying, "Bro, you are a white Jesus. That was a miracle. Give me your business cards. I'm going to send all my customers to you." Sure enough, Doucette soon got a call. The student said, "You're a miracle worker. I caught a charge. I need your help." The next day, Doucette got two more calls. Then in March, on his birthday, he received an email announcing someone had bought him a domain, durhamweedlawyer.com. The client had put his marketing skills to work. He says, "So it ended up, by the middle of 2015, most of the people in Durham who were selling weed in a given part of town, I was their defense attorney." To this day, many of his clients are still charged with drug-related crimes. He also represents protesters, whether from the Moral Mondays movement or Black Lives Matter protests, a part of his practice he describes as his ministry. He said, "I do stuff on Twitter, but I also like being in the courtroom and being able to defend people who are being oppressed by their government." At its peak, his law firm, which is located on East Main Street, had multiple attorneys, interns, and a receptionist. Then, in 2016, he made a long-shot bid for state senate in a district that includes Durham County. Though he won more votes than any Republican to run for the seat and got an endorsement from Indy, he still lost badly to incumbent Mike Woodard. He said, "It was an incredibly stupid decision. and it almost bankrupted his firm. Immersing himself in his campaign meant less time for marketing and finding new clients. His business crumbled, his attorneys left. The next year was dreadful. He wrote in a blog post in April of 2017, "I've fallen into this rat race of churning through cases at the law firm to make rent each month, but don't really feel like I'm moving forward toward any given objective beyond rent paying, which is a fantastically low goal in life. It's terribly frustrating, especially for someone who's climbed up from how far down I was back in 2000, and the way forward is a complete mystery to me." Today, Doucette is the only employee at his firm. Because of the pandemic, he works most days from home, where he lives with his wife, Jean Chen, an optometrist he married in October, and kids, a dog and two cats. When he goes into the office two times a week, it's very quiet, and he keeps iTunes playing in the background. Beneath the cocky exterior, Doucette feels for others. Since 2015, he has organized an annual fundraiser to provide groceries for underprivileged elementary school kids in Durham. This year, he raised over $55,000. Lowe's lent him an 18-wheeler to transport 3,642 bags of groceries. Myers Davis recalls he had that truly human ability to put himself into people's situations and to care for them as individuals. Many of his clients of the firm, even folks that I've worked with, have come back and said, "You know, I'm doing this and this because Greg gave me advice, not as my attorney, but as a person who really cared about me." His strong feelings about police violence aren't new. He says he's been sharing videos of police misconduct for the past 13 years. He wrote in one of his tweets, "Do I hate police? No, I hate raging, incompetent cowboys with badges financed by my tax money who clearly haven't had an eye exam recently." Doucette also rants about police misconduct on his podcast, which is a secondary source of income. In his slight southern drawl, Doucette calls out cops from across the country, a North Carolina sex crimes detective who committed sex crimes, a Florida deputy who framed motorists for drug offenses, Texas cops who beat a domestic violence victim. Dayaska Swetman, one of his law school classmates, says he's showing that you don't have to be black to call out social injustice. His megaphone is loud, not just because he's really good in the Twitterverse, but his megaphone is loud because he really, really cares. He really has been fighting this fight from the beginning. Next, from Anne Blythe, pardon me, Care Comunidad, how Latinx healthcare providers united against COVID-19. It was the first first Wednesday after Thanksgiving, and Durham County's COVID-19 cases were surging much more rapidly than Rodney Jenkins, the county health director, wanted to see. Governor Roy Cooper had tried to thwart large gatherings by limiting crowds to no more than 10 people, pleading with people to stay home and to forego travel over the holiday weekend. Some heeded the governor's counsel. Others ignored his missives. Jenkins joined a Zoom call at noon that day with words of thanks for a group that has played a pivotal role in helping to get public health messages to a small but exponentially important segment of the Durham County community hit disproportionately hard by COVID-19. Jenkins told the Zoom call participants, "Late spring, early summer, our Latinx population was representing up to 78% of all our active cases. 78%. As it stands right now, although still overrepresented, they represent 20% of all our active cases. So again, to go from 78 to 20 is a Herculean effort, and I just say thank you. Thank you to you all. Thank you." The group attracting the health director's praise was formed by Viviana Martinez Bianchi and Gabriella Maradiaga Paniotti, two Duke health physicians, who decided in early March to formalize a discussion that had been going on among the two women and several of their Latina colleagues since August of 2019. As the end of 2020 approaches, many have looked back on the work of their group as an unexpected gift during such a staggering year. Maradiaga Paniotti, a Honduran who came to this country in the late 1990s to further her education, was deeply troubled by a mass shooting at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas, in late 2019. A young white man from Dallas had opened fire inside the store, targeting Hispanics, killing 23, injuring 22 others, according to law enforcement, and leaving a community jarred by the alleged motives. That knotted her. She knew others from south of the U.S. border had to be tied up inside, too, and sought their friendship, support, and counsel for how they could help Latinx patients who were as troubled as they were. At the beginning of the year, the Duke Health colleagues spoke mostly among themselves. Then in early March, when North Carolina reported its first COVID-19 case, Maradiaga Paniotti, Martinez Bianchi, and others foresaw the importance of elevating the voices of communities of color during a global pandemic. They came together officially as Latinx Advocacy Team, an interdisciplinary network for COVID-19, or Latin-19. Not only has the group been meeting on Zoom weekly since March 18th, they welcome others to listen, join in the discussion, and share information about unsung health programs, new COVID-related apps, and more. They highlight long-standing and systemic health care access disparities that continue to plague this state and elsewhere. Latin 19 members helped get the word out to Latinx communities about the importance of mask wearing and social distancing. They helped stage community testing events and stressed the importance of getting tested, especially for frontline workers. Lately, they've been talking about the promise of COVID vaccines and the challenges of getting them to Latinx residents, while also tackling the thorny questions about the vaccine's trustworthiness and effectiveness, as well as the science behind them. Maradiaga Paniotti and Martinez Bianchi received the first dose of the Pfizer vaccine last week at Duke Health, sharing photos and videos on social media and Univision to show their trust in the new weapons against the virus. Jenkins has joined the Latin 19 Zoom sessions more than once, even as workloads in his and other county health departments get more and more daunting. He said, "It's your advocacy, it's your willingness to really get the word out that has helped us. But make no mistake about it, we have work to do because our Latinx per population in Durham represents 14% of the population. For us to have 20% of cases is decent at best." Latin 19 takes its focus and mission beyond Duke Health in Durham County. Martinez Bianchi has spoken at statewide press briefings and with people who shape policies, regulations, and crucial messages. The group gets the word out in English and Spanish with interpreters and a Zoom call interpretation tool that makes it possible for listeners to choose whether to hear the conversation in English or Spanish. Though through sharing the stories from the ground up, Latin 19 was able to change the visitation policy at Duke Health for children in the hospital's care. When an infectious disease specialist was a guest on one of their Zoom sessions and heard that Latinx parents were reluctant to bring their sick children in because they didn't want to leave them alone, the visitation policy was changed for the pediatric care unit. Catherine Pollack, a Duke professor in population health sciences, who has sat in on the sessions and proposed research projects to evaluate the impact of Latin 19, says that's huge. Typically, in her research, Pollack creates the program she's going to measure, but Latin 19 was already in the works when she decided to write about their reach. She had done research on Latinx communities for a while and was well acquainted with Martinez Bianchi through work. She decided to attend one Zoom session and kept coming back each week. Pollock said, "It's pretty phenomenal what they've been able to do." Now that vaccines are on the way, the discussion has turned to how to build enthusiasm for a tool so vital to ushering in the end of this pandemic. Latin 19 leaders know they have hard work ahead. A national survey of 1,050 black adults and 258 Latinx adults done this fall for Unidos US, the NAACP, and the COVID Collaborative found that 34% of the Latinx Americans and only 14% of the black Americans trusted the safety of a vaccine. The COVID Collaborative, comprised of national health, education, and economic experts, launched a $50 million national vaccine education campaign in late November. Janet Marguilla, president of the Unidos U.S., said in a statement announcing a partnership with COVID Collaborative, "Like all Americans, Latinos want to do what's best for their families and their communities. Through this education and awareness campaign, we will help Hispanic Americans have the accurate and easy-to-understand information they need to protect themselves, families, and communities by getting vaccinated," Marguilla added. Here in North Carolina, Latin 19 has developed many contacts through the pandemic and is already attacking some of the questions and even misinformation that have been circulating. In the Zoom discussions, Pablo Friedman, director of Durham Public Schools Multilingual Resource Center, often brings questions to the group that he hears from school children and their families. On December 2nd, he shared questions that came up during a conversation with his mother about people who don't have health insurance and might experience side effects from the vaccines. And Friedman asked, "For folks that do have negative side effects from things and they don't have current insurance, what is going to be their process for getting health coverage and support? I think these are very real fears and mistrust that are going on. This has always been my fear from the very beginning." Some have been confused about the meaning of a positive test for COVID and whether they are actively contagious. And Maradiaga Panayoti says, "As with other things, transparency and clarity is essential, and I think it is so important for us to voice all these concerns and address them head on." She said that transparency needs to extend to colleagues in workplaces and to the public. "As soon as there is a sense of hiding or not sharing, the wall will cement itself." Many groups get together and have lofty discussions about how to help communities in need. What's different with Latin 19 is that the ideas and projects generated quickly translate into implementation. Jenkins, who became the head of Durham County Health Department in early 2020, told the group earlier this month how instrumental their help was as he found his way in a new city after 8 years as deputy director for Cumberland County Health Department. And he said, "Being new, I didn't know who the players were. But you all step up to the plate. We've reached out to you all, and your efforts have really paid dividends." The group members also have benefited from working with each other. Martinez Bianchi said, "I've been asked to be representing Latin 19 in other places, and the one thing I have to say is that I don't feel alone. I feel in the company of an amazing group of people. As a Latina who's been taking care of members of the Comunidad Latina for so many years, I have to say that it is totally the first time I don't feel so alone in the care I'm providing and in getting what I've been hearing for so many years from my Comunidad, from my patients, understood by others who may not have that connection as a clinician. I feel like I'm in the company of brothers and sisters and members of a community who really care, and it feels really, really good." that sentiment of togetherness, empowerment, and a proud sense of moving ideas to deliverables was echoed by others in the group. One participant described coming to the Zoom sessions as like finding a lighthouse. Durham City Council member Javiera Caballero said the group's advocacy reminded local government officials of the need to make virtual meetings accessible in Spanish and other languages. Maradiego Panayaji said, "This has been such a tough year for all of us. There's been so much negative news and bad news. This group has been such a good reminder to be aspirational and to realize the power of what can be done when people set their mind to it. And people, as so many of you have said, have a vision, and a unified vision, so we all believe in it, and we're all willing to put in the time. We're unstoppable," she continued. "We can do it." She said that the group's work felt tangible and was a good reminder of the power of unity, especially in the face of adversity. And she closed, "So much disastrous stuff that's happening. I sort of tried to remind myself, like, okay, Latin 19, look what's happening. This is amazing. I try to use it as my anchor point of positivity in a world of so much topsy-turvy stuff happening." And the article closed by saying it was published in partnership with North Carolina Health News, which originally ran a longer version of the article on its website. Now, news from Chapel Hill by Sarah Pequeño, High Crimes. An 11th-hour announcement from the U.S. Department of Justice and Orange County Sheriff's Office right at the end of 2020 dropped a bomb on the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. It reverberated across the country. 21 people were indicted for moving serious weight in a small college town with fewer than 60,000 residents. They're accused of selling over 1,000 pounds of marijuana, a few hundred pounds of cocaine, and other narcotics at the university. Three UNC Chapel Hill fraternities, Beta Theta Pi, Phi Gamma Delta, and Kappa Sigma, were name-dropped by the department as the site of drug sales, and frat brothers were implicated too. Investigators found that the cocaine was being shipped through USPS from California to the state, while marijuana was being driven in. Cash from the drug sales was also shipped through the Postal Service, according to law enforcement. Another $1.3 million was sent through money orders and mobile apps. Justice Department doesn't know how much money was circulated in all because of the drug ring, thanks to the use of paper money, but it was cited to be well over $1.5 million. The four people said to be involved in fraternities were allegedly pretty sloppy. Photos and drug prices were sent through iMessage and a similar platform called GroupMe. Money was sent over Venmo and PayPal. U.S. Attorney Matthew G.T. Martin said at December 17th press conference, "This isn't a situation where you have single users, where you have a 19-year-old sipping a beer, where you have someone taking a puff of a joint on the back porch of a frat house. These are 21 hardened drug dealers." The so-called hardened drug dealers are fairly young. 27-year-old Francisco Javier Ochoa Jr., the rig's accused primary supplier, is one of the oldest people involved in the case. Over half of those indicted were 22 to 24. More than half were Triangle residents, while only two lived outside of North Carolina. The youngest of the indicted, David Beja, was set to graduate to the university in 2021, according to LinkedIn and Facebook accounts. Despite this, UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Kevin Guskiewicz says no current students from the school were involved, only former ones. U.S. Attorney Martin said in a statement, "No one is above the law, including college students and fraternity members at elite universities. This serious drug trafficking is destructive and reckless, and many lives have been ruined. This investigation reveals that the fraternity culture at these universities is dangerous. University administrators and national chapters cannot turn a blind eye to the impact on these students and the environment on their respective college campuses." The day after that press conference, Guskiewicz announced the school would suspend the three fraternities. Named an investigation, the school's Phi Gamma Delta chapter was also suspended by its national organization. Suspension, according to the Interfraternity Council's constitution, means the three fraternities are in poor standing. It's unclear what that means in terms of punishment. In 2013, Chi Phi was suspended at UNC after a student pledging the organization died with a blood alcohol level three times the legal limit. Members were allowed to continue living at the house, but any fraternity-related activities like mixers, parties, or meetings were stalled until the investigation was finalized. Chi Phi, or Chi Phi, is still recognized by the university and recruits pledge classes. Removing these fraternities from campus may seem like a logical next step, but it's not a simple one. In 2019, the school stripped Sigma Alpha Epsilon of university recognition, meaning it no longer receives support or funding from the Office of Fraternity and Sorority Life and lost the privileges of creating fraternity, intramural teams, and reserving spaces on campus. Their national organization did not release a statement at the time regarding the closure of its Tar Heel chapter. For UNC Chapel Hill to remove a fraternity from campus, they'd also have to get past a network of wealthy and notable alumni. Hugh McCall, former CEO of Bank of America, was in Beta. Former North Carolina Governor Mike Easley was in Phi Gamma Delta, as was UNC building namesake Zebulon Vance. Legendary UNC basketball coach Dean Smith was a brother, but through the Kansas chapter. While Kappa Sigma does not list any notable UNC on its website, U.S. Senator Richard Burr was in his chapter at Wake Forest University. The uncovering of the Chapel Hill drug ring also raises questions about drug abuse in the area. While public awareness of the opioid crisis has risen in recent years, cocaine use has slowly increased thanks to its heightened production and availability, according to a 2018 report from the Department of Justice. The same report says North Carolina has seen gang members working in union with Mexican cartels. UNC Chapel Hill offers drug counseling to its students through the Carolina Recovery Program, a weekly group meeting currently held online. Narcotics Anonymous separately offers local programs. The County Health Department partners with other organizations to offer multiple avenues to addiction recovery. UNC Health has an inpatient substance abuse program. The Carolina Recovery Program did not respond to questions regarding specific new or existing addiction outreach efforts within fraternities or in the general student population. UNC Media Relations could not be reached for comment. UNC and Chapel Hill police were in the midst of grappling with Silent Sam protest while a slow burn drug investigation continued just a block away on Cameron Avenue. When asked about any increase in patrolling since the massive drug indictment, the Chapel Hill Police Department deferred to the Orange County Sheriff's Department. The county office deferred to the U.S. Department of Justice. A Justice Department representative could not comment on any future steps that would be taken. We have some time for some arts information now, or articles, and this from Music is by Keisha Jennings, and the title is Sold on Growth. When the Raleigh rapper Malcolm Brown, also known as the Deep End, was a child, he'd often sneak off to listen to New Orleans native Juvenile, or Jay-Z. He found himself drawn to the music, his church-going mother not so much. Born in New York City, Brown and his mother transplanted to Charlotte, North Carolina, when he was six. This move was accompanied by a new relationship with religion for the family. And he says, "The first year in Charlotte, my mom randomly takes me to church on a Wednesday night. You know when they do the altar call? I don't know why, but God picks me. He was like, 'Yo, tell your mom let's go down there.' She wasn't going to go down to the altar, but I grabbed her hand and was like, 'Mom, let's go get saved.' So we went down and got saved. And you know, It's a good thing, but at the same time, I didn't know what I was signing myself up for. Despite the rigid expectations of religion beginning when he was 7, Brown found himself scribbling raps in his notebook during church services. And he recalls, I literally spent my childhood cast off from hip-hop, listening to Radio Disney and Christian music. By middle school, he made the conscious decision to listen to rap despite his mother's wishes. His love for Kanye inspired him to not only consume the music, but also to embody it, performing in his 7th grade talent show. Brown says, the day of the talent show, my homie misses school. So we're doing the talent show, and it's my turn to go. I go up there. I spit my verse. Everybody loves it, so I'm feeling myself. And because I'm feeling myself, when his verse comes on, instead of just ending the performance early, I try to freestyle, and I have nothing. I choke. Everybody laughs at me. It took some time for him to get over the embarrassment, but by college, the thriving hip-hop culture embedded in North Carolina State University's campus, alongside his love of writing poetry, helped him find his way back. In 2013, during his senior year at State, he dropped his first project, 13 Feet Deep. It was well received on campus, and he branched out and began performing shows throughout the Triangle, eventually getting the opportunity to open for Big KRIT and local supporters, Cooley High. Since then, he's landed prime performance slots at Packapalooza, Hopscotch, and Beats and Bars Festival. Throughout all this, Brown credits God for placing the right people in his life at the right time. Whether it was receiving a used MacBook, or beat machine from an old roommate, or networking with a novice videographer interested in creating free visuals for him, making music has always come together in a kinetic, authentic way for Brown. Since his first release, Brown has put out a steady stream of projects. Think Good Thoughts, 2017, Calm, 2018, Verano, 2019, and Northern Lights, 2020. His newest project, In My Head, was released in early December as a Bandcamp exclusive. The album has since become available on other platforms. With each release, Brown offers listeners a new conceptual theme ranging from introspective and reflective to up-tempo and celebratory. The true Scorpio. He sees music as the tool he's most comfortable using to self-reflect. And his stage moniker captures the essence of where he resides, at his core, on the deep end. When describing In My Head, he notes that the project is on a frequency similar to Think Good Thoughts, but times a thousand. The pandemic quickly shifted our collective understandings of normalcy. For Brown, it forced him into isolation and triggered a series of self-reflecting conversations about life. These are all documented on In My Head. With each successive release, Brown has also become more intentional about marketing his products, often by showcasing his skills as an MC or producer. This includes his decision to release In My Head through Bandcamp over, say, Spotify or Tidal, as it's a platform that centers artists and aims to create a more sustainable music economy. The album's rollout was also impressive. Brown provided his audience with visuals, including short 2 to 3 minute episodes featuring the creatives who contributed to the product. My music is too good to not be heard, Brown says. It's not a sense of entitlement like, people have to hear me, but it's kind of just like, I should be doing everything I can to maximize every project's visibility. One way I've grown is I now read and study marketing. I utilize my resources. Also, I'm super focused on the artistry side because you could do all this marketing stuff, but you also have to have a good project. Mastering this skill, one most indie artists struggled with, has paid off and allowed him to make more revenue off of In My Head than previous efforts. The project also recently landed on Bandcamp's top 50 best-selling hip-hop albums rolling weekly list, an accomplishment worth celebrating. And Brown isn't letting up either. He has a clear understanding of where he needs to go. I'm trying to continue to learn the business, he says. This includes figuring out more creative content to post, building my team out and learning from others. I feel like I'm getting close to my 10,000 hours as a rapper. I just need to make sure my business is correct. And I believe a final article by Sarah Edwards I might have time for. Home Truth is about a mini documentary. If you drove past the executive mansion at Blunt Street in Raleigh on Election Day and January 1st, the beginning of Roy Cooper's second term, you would have glimpsed a small group of demonstrators outside, gathered in camping chairs and holding signs with the names of incarcerated people. These activists stood in rain or shine solidarity with more than 30,000 people, most of them black, who are incarcerated inside state prisons. Decarcerate NC Now, Let Our People Go is a mini-documentary created by the Wilmington-based arts organization Working Narrative, charts that 58-day vigil. At just over 18 minutes, the film is a moving testament to the tireless fight for decarceration. Christy Puckett-Williams, statewide manager for the ACLU of North Carolina's Campaign for Smart Justice, says in the film, "From the beginning, we said we were going to be like our comrades in Hong Kong, who have said their strategy was to be like water." And Andrea Muffin Hudson, director of the North Carolina Community Bail Fund of Durham, "I have a choice to be out here or not be out here. People who are incarcerated don't have a choice. I choose to endure because I want to stand in that gap for them." The vigil was more than candles or commemoration. It was a direct call to action for the governor, who at the onset of the demonstration was the first North Carolina governor in more than 40 years to not exercise clemency power. That inaction, particularly during a pandemic in which North Carolina prisons have seen some of the state's worst COVID outbreaks, is, activists in the film say, a violence. Oh, and that word, violence, conjures up violins. So I'd better conjure up a violin and a piano to close this edition of Indie Week. Now, if you all are hungry to hear it over and over and over again, just get over to our website, ncreadingservice.org. Look for the podcast section and the word independent. Well, my mighty brain has better stop talking now to finish our music. I'll be back, hopefully, in a week with, of course, Indie Week. So long.